Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Deborah Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the fourth week of January. This week, we are pleased to bring you an encore presentation of part two of our interview with Francis Wood and Govinda Rossling of the Pidgeon-Guillemot Research Group on Whidbey Island as the main part of our program, which was recorded about a year ago. Our trusty sound engineer and editor, Nora Petrich, is with me this week to help share current observations and events. Welcome, Nora.
Hi, Debron.
But before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. Isn't this an interesting call? We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you what it is. As some of you will have heard, there has been some recent good news for our southern resident orca population. A new baby whale was spotted in L Pod a couple of weeks ago. This brings the number of individuals up to 75. With the young one photographed friskily following the oldest member of the tribe, 90-year-old Ocean Sun. The baby's mother is 32-year-old Matya.
Bald eagles have also been preparing for the breeding season, with several of our local eagle lovers commenting on seeing pairs carrying new tree branches in to refurbish their nests. The eagles return to the same nests year after year, continuing to build them up until they are massive, up to 9 feet in diameter and weighing up to 2,000 pounds.
Wow.
Yeah. Bald eagles do not breed until they are 4 to 6 years old, but when they pair for mating, they tend to remain paired for life. The egg-laying season is generally late winter to early spring. In western Washington, sometime during the last days of February and the first days of March, the female lays 2 eggs. Both parents incubate the egg for 34 to 36 days. For the first 2 weeks after the young hatch, one parent is with the chicks almost constantly. The young do not start to fly until they are 10 to 12 weeks old, and the parents continue to feed and defend them for another 2 to 3 months.
One of the reasons that bald eagles are so successful in our area is because they eat such a wide range of food types. We think of them as fish eaters, but they are also very good scavengers and also capable of hunting down other waterfowl. Jeff Hammerson sent us a great photo of a bald eagle carrying off an unwary American coot from Kai Tai Lagoon a few days ago, and they are well known to pluck off gulls and other shorebirds and waterfowl.
Birding in our mixed woodland forests may be a bit boring right now, but it is offset by exciting views of our wintering waterfowl, both on freshwater lakes and on the salt water. Fred Sharp reported seeing a very large group of about 200 common murres feeding on dense aggregations of herring off Adelma Beach last week, with large groups of American widgeons, bufflehead, and red-breasted merganser ducks, and brant geese seen elsewhere.
All of our mild weather the last couple of weeks has seemed to make the leaf buds on the salmonberry and red-flowering currant bushes fatten up and show some green. And we even saw a tall Oregon grape shrub breaking out into bright yellow flower a few days ago. Some plants have not yet lost their flowers from last year. Jeff Hammerson sent us a photo of gumweed still retaining some of its bright yellow blooms, and also sent photos of a fat black cottonwood tree bud starting to ooze sticky rosin, which gives off the most heavenly musky scent, along with willow tree catkins emerging and lengthening. He also found some yellow-rumped warblers foraging at the Kai Tai Nature Park, which he reckoned were wintering here from their normal breeding grounds in Alaska or boreal Canada. And now, on to part two of our interview with Francis Wood and Govinda Rossling, who were gracious enough to join us in the studio a few weeks ago to speak about their work with the delightful Pidgeon-Guillemots of Whidbey Island. How many sites do you monitor on Whidbey Island, and how many birds are there in the study area?
This is Govinda here. Whidbey Island is home to about 25, 28 colonies. We are getting around 1,000 pigeon guillemots around Whidbey Island year after year. That's been pretty stable. It's volunteer-based, so our volunteers, they go out once a week with a pair of binoculars. Like Francis says, they just become a piece of driftwood with their back to the bluff, and it's an observational study, so they're counting how many guillemots are associated with the colony, and they are writing down the times and the fish type that the guillemot brings its prey to the chicks, which are in the burrows behind the volunteers.
But you're not banding the birds just because it's so difficult to access the breeding sites, right? And it's intrusive.
Both of those are very good points. Some of these burrows are up 100 feet high. Some of these burrows go back 5 feet into the bluff. This truly is an observational study, so we're not being intrusive and we're just kind of hanging back and letting them do their pigeon guillemot thing, and we're just quietly recording what they do.
Speaking of their pigeon guillemot thing, a friend of mine who works up in Southeast Alaska says that there are pigeon guillemots everywhere there. He was telling me about how animated their breeding behavior is, that they like do little dances and twirls and hiss and trill. What's been your experience with those behaviors? Do you record behavior, or you're mostly focusing on prey items that they bring to the burrow?
Yeah, this is Frances. The study itself is based on this set of criteria that we're looking for, this protocol that we're following. Part of the attraction, I think, of this survey for our volunteers is, as you mentioned, these are extremely entertaining birds. During the breeding season, they carry out kind of do-si-dos in the water, or kind of a leapfrog where they're going after each other and tumbling around each other, and then they will take off and fly around through the air, and all this time producing a wonderful trill sound. So they're very vocal as well as being very playful.
Do they mate for life? Do we know enough about them to know if they have stable breeding pairs?
In places where they have been banded, and there is a survey on Protection Island where they have banded the birds, a smaller number of birds there, the consensus is that they do come back to the same burrow or a neighboring burrow, and that oftentimes the birds return as mates again. I think the term bonding for life is probably a little too strict for what most birds do.
Uh-huh. I study spotted owls, and for them, it really is a strict bond. Occasionally, a pair member dies, they'll take on another mate, but usually it'll be the same pair for 12 years.
Right, and I think it's a little bit different with these colony nesting birds.
Uh-huh. That there's lots of temptation there.
Well, maybe so. Are we reading into this?
Is there a lot of variation in breeding colony size and where the burrows are located?
As Govinda said, we have kind of a fluctuating number of colonies, somewhere between 25 and 28 on Whidbey Island. Some of those colonies can be as small as maybe 8 to 10 birds, and then we have some colonies that have over 100 birds. They all, with a few exceptions, choose to make their burrows in the very steep erosional bluffs around the island. They will often use abandoned kingfisher burrows to use as their place where they lay their eggs. They don't create any cute little nest in there. There's no little circle of pebbles or anything. They just lay their eggs right inside the burrow. We do have some places around Whidbey where they are breeding on man-made structures. One of our long-term successful study sites is the structure that is off of the Coopville or Keystone Ferry Terminal there. There's that abandoned structure out there, and they have found little crevices near the top of that where they go in and breed. And we have a couple of other wharfs. We are pretty convinced that they also breed under the Clinton Ferry Dock and at the Langley Marina, at the dock there.
Do they have to have a certain degree of non-disturbance? Areas like that where they're in a structure, can they withstand disturbing?
I would say the guillemots, it depends on the colony. there are some colonies that we have that are on a beach that doesn't have any walkers, and I'll do a survey, and I'll just cross my legs, and they will fly off. Mm-hmm. Whereas we have other beaches like Mutiny Sands that is kind of a more sandy beach and vacation homes, and people are walking on those beaches with their dogs all the time, and the guillemots, they don't even bat a bird eyelash to them. Mm-hmm. So I think they can kind of get used to people. We still want to give them as much distance as running through their colony or anything. Uh-huh. But
yeah, and people have to be really careful with their dogs, yes, too. That, I mean, usually their burrows are located high enough in the cliff that the dogs can't get at them, right? But I would think I was reading some awful study where they were finding that a pet dog had a huge impact on an auklet colony. People and their dogs need to be careful sometimes.
Exactly. We try to encourage beach walkers to just proceed quickly through the guillemot breeding area and then proceed down the beach. We in no way try to monitor people and their activities on the beach, but we do try to educate. So it's so often our volunteers, people ask questions why they're sitting there on the beach, why do they have a clipboard and so forth, and they begin talking about these birds. And people that have walked the beach for years and have never really known about these amazing colonies of birds. So it's also been an aspect of our study that I think has been very successful is the way we've been able to have our volunteers educate their neighbors as appropriate or other people just to spread the word about how fun these birds are.
Yeah, that's great. They're so quick when they feed the young. There's a beach that I monitor for coasts across from Protection Island. I have seen a couple of times just a single pigeon guillemot fly in with food to the bluff and notice that there's a hole there, but they're so quick, they just dart in and are out again. If you weren't there at the right time, you would never, you'd look at that hole and go, now I wonder what lives there.
So. Yeah, I've had that same experience before I even started studying these birds. I watched them fly into the bluff, and I mean, my first reaction was that this bird is going to just go splat against the cliff. But of course, there was a hole there, and it just disappeared right into the hole.
What happens to the juveniles when they disperse? I've read that they emerge at night and go straight into the water. Do they just swim off and feed independently, or do the adults continue to care for them after they're fledged?
Yeah, literature states that typically the guillemots will fledge at night. However, I have seen a fledging at 9 o'clock in the morning. It's back in 2010, and I was doing a survey on the east side of the island, which is really pebbly. It's not sandy like the west side. And I heard something behind me, and I looked over, and it was a guillemot tumbled. They haven't grown their primaries yet, and they're really like fluffy and down. They've been eating a lot of fish for the last month, so they're just
kind of plump,
big and fat. Yeah. So he tumbles down, and then he beelines it out to the water. Actually, I had a video camera with me, and I recorded it.
Oh, so how cool!
Go to our website, pigeonguillemot.org, and we have a 10-second video or so of this kind of blurry guillemot running on the pebbles. He fell down a couple of times, and then I think I held my breath during the filming and then finally let out a gasp when he dove into the water. But basically, they're on their own. They feed themselves. We have seen juveniles kind of begging for food or maybe even palling around with the adults, but typically, once they fledge, they're on their own, and we'll maybe see them next year.
It's amazing that they would know how to feed themselves, isn't it? I mean, because they've just been fed in this dark hole for, 30 days? Is it usually about that long?
I would say the adults consume their own prey underwater, and the juveniles, they are still learning, and sometimes they'll come up with prey and sort of choke down that fish.
Uh-huh.
But it is interesting. That instinct is there to, this is where I get food. This is safety.
Just to add to that, the juveniles, after they leave the burrow, there's about a 2 or 3 week period when their wings do not support flight. So they are flightless and they are diving for food. And like Govinda said, even though as adults they will ingest their food underwater, these juveniles pop up to the surface with something odd in their mouths and they kind of try to get it down. I think Govinda has seen what crab and various different things that they've tried.
Yeah,
little tiny things. Yeah,
one isn't quite right.
They've tried to, had to learn by trial and error there.
Oh, that's funny. So have you seen any changes in population numbers or in behavior over the course of your study?
What's quite remarkable about our study is that that number of 1,000 population that we counted the first year of our full island survey has been consistent over 8 to 10 years. We occasionally have fluctuation in the sizes of different colonies, but somehow the birds average themselves out to keep that population of 1,000 very consistent. As far as the breeding success goes, it's been a little bit more variable. Since there are quite a few birds, probably subadults or maybe unmated birds or birds that haven't found a burrow, about only 30% or 40% of our birds will be breeding at any one year. So there are a lot of extra ones sort of palling around there. Certain colonies produce a higher number of probable breeding successes each year, but our numbers have stayed pretty consistent on that as well. Govinda, do you have some more on that?
I would say another part of our study is looking at certainly the population of the guillemot, but also what the composition of the prey is.
Uh-huh.
And there are three basic fish types that we're looking at. Gunnel, which is that long eel-like fish. Sculpin, which is more of like a spiny, bullhead, double ugly of a fish. And then we have an other category, like sometimes it's sand lance or crab. We had an intern who got a photo of a squid.
Whoa.
A couple years ago. But I would say most often it's gunnel that they are choosing to feed those chicks, followed by sculpin and then followed by other.
Uh-huh. And do they have just one chick in each burrow?
They typically will hatch two eggs, uh-huh. two chicks in each burrow.
So it doesn't change, it doesn't seem to be changing, but that's part of what the information that you collect, and baseline information, is you're trying to figure out how the food types might change year to year, right? But at the moment, it seems pretty steady.
Yeah, I would say for the would-be population, we're getting about 50% is gunnel with 20% with sculp and the other 20 or 25% with other areas like South Sound. They have quite a bit more gunnel, maybe 65%. Over in Clallam County, it's around 67% of gunnel fish types, gunnel and prickleback, that the guillemots are feeding to their chicks.
Uh-huh.
It does vary, and I think as we have more surveys in different areas, then we can gain a fuller picture of
see
what's
if there's
happening.
Variability depending on where the birds are
yes.
feeding and living. Mm-hmm. When we spoke earlier on the phone, you were telling me some great stories of unusual things that you've observed with the birds, including some surprising burrow mates that the guillemots have had.
I was filling in for a volunteer over in Mutiny Bay one morning. I saw an orange wing in what would have been burrow number 15, and it was very surprising. I thought it was being maybe predated on, and I kind of stood up and looked around, and I couldn't peek in the burrow. It's up 30 feet, but as you walk back, you can kind of look in, and actually there were two barn owls that had taken up residence in this burrow. Quite surprising.
I know, but not with the guillemots.
Not with the guillemots.
I know.
I think
you
they got their
not.
Own.
Yeah.
They got their own burrow.
Yeah. We've also found guillemots breeding in some very unusual places, as opposed to their more typical erosional bluff. There's a lot of breeding on steep, rocky cliffs and so forth. When my husband and I were up in Haida Gwaii a couple years ago, we noticed that on the ferry that connects two of the islands up there, that there were these guillemots sitting on the railing as the ferry was moving from one island to the other. And we asked one of the guys on the ferry that was helping to load the cars, and he said, oh, they breed right here underneath the loading ramp.
Wow.
And so they had found a little spot there. We also had the report from one of the other members of our team that there was a sailboat had been moored in Holmes Harbor on the east side of Whidbey Island, and that when the people owning the boat finally got around to taking it out, must have been mid-June, they realized the two little eggs were sitting right inside one of their portholes that had been left open, and evidently the guillemots had come in and saw that round porthole and thought this would be a great little cavity to lay their eggs.
Oh, opportunistic then.
Yes.
I don't suppose that they were able to hatch those out, the folks.
No. These are the exception, of course.
So you've expanded your study in recent years to include some sites over in Clallam County. How many sites do you monitor on the Olympic Peninsula?
There is a new study. I think Clallam County is in their second year.
A friend of mine is helping with one of those. Yeah, Carrie Williamson is working. Is it Salt Creek?
Bachelor Rock.
That's right. She loves it. Actually, it's really fun.
Along with Bachelor Rock, there's five other colonies in Clallam County, and from Bachelor Rock to the far west to Panorama Vista at Port Williams.
You were mentioning when we last spoke how you were hoping to get some surveys started in Jefferson County.
That would be awesome.
Yeah.
We're looking for some volunteers if anybody wants to join us.
All you listeners out there, actually, I would love to volunteer too. Do you have any special target areas where you'd like to get people to watch?
Well, I think we're just kind of looking for the local folks here in Port Townsend to tell us where they're seeing guillemots. You tell us where you've seen them, and we can come up with a survey.
A little training. You go through a training.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And so that people are collecting information the same way, and there's a set protocol.
Yeah,
right,
there
people
is.
People follow.
Yes, there is a set protocol, and if you go to our website, www.pigeonguillemot.org, our protocol is written, and you can read through it, and you can contact us, certainly, with any questions. Or if you'd like to maybe think about joining us here in Jefferson County, go to guillemotresearch@gmail.com.
Great.
To contact us.
Yeah,
thanks.
Well, hopefully you'll be flooded with people wanting to start up. Their New Year's resolution in January will be, we want to study guillemots.
Just to try to sweeten the pot here a little bit and let the volunteers know a little bit more what they're in for. The volunteer studies consist of 1 hour per week on the beach. It's summer duty. We promise warm breezes and sunny skies and no fog. And hopefully a lovely sort of quiet meditative time on the beach while they're doing the survey.
And they get to see guillemots, which,
exactly.
I mean, what more reward do you need? They're just so delightful. Thanks so much for coming and sharing with us. There are several fine upcoming natural history events taking place this weekend. First, join the Natural History Society on Friday, January 25th, for a four-mile walk between North Beach and Middle Point through the Quimper Wildlife Corridor from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Go to saveland.org to RSVP and get more information.
Admiralty Audubon has a field trip planned for the following day, Saturday the 26th, to Fort Casey and Crockett Lagoon over on Whidbey Island. Go to admiraltyaudubon.org for details.
That same morning, the Olympic chapter of the Audubon Society is sponsoring a field trip to Edith's Hook, focusing on returning winter water and shorebirds of Port Angeles Harbor and the Strait of Juan de Fuca. Meet at 10:30 a.m. up in Port Angeles and go to olympicpeninsulaaudubon.org for more information.
You'll have some difficult choices ahead because Orca Network is also hosting their annual Ways of the Whale workshop over on Whidbey Island next Saturday. The workshop runs all day from 10 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. and features various guest speakers and topics. Go to orcanetwork.org to register and get more information.
And here's our mystery sound again. It's a black turnstone, and they are one of our most common winter resident shorebirds, part of the very large and diverse sandpiper family. They usually arrive in late summer and stay until April, when they leave for the breeding season up in Alaska. They are a compact, short-billed bird, found primarily on rocky shores. All plumages are mostly black with white bellies. Their bellies and underwings are white, and their heads and breasts are black. And in flight, they flash a dramatic black and white chevron pattern. They're very vocal, with shrill rattles and chatter, and they often serve as sentinels for other species of shorebirds feeding along with them, the first to sound the alarm call. They are very busy birds, working in generally small groups, though sometimes gathering in flocks of 100 or more. They work up and down a rocky coast, turning over rocks with their strong bills, hence their name, looking for choice morsels. They also can be seen helping the port out with cleaning duty along the jetties of the boat haven. Our friend Rick Altman describes how he often sees them bustling about near where his boat, the Cape Clear, is moored, clearing all of the concrete seams of the walkway of moss. They should be on the payroll. Our thanks to the great birding resource, birdweb.org, and the Cornell Lab of Ornithology for the recording. And that's it for KPTC's Nature Now for the fourth week of the new year. Thanks very much for joining me, Nora, and thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 12:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. As always, happy trails.
Happy trails.
Today's closing music is Whidbey Island Blues, performed by the Seattle group The Maldives.
I fall apart. Apart from you, you said don't worry, there's no hurry, and I listen. And I've grown so old out here on my own. You can take me, but don't shake me. If you break me, I will break you. So take my advice.